Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on April 12, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call discussing some of the practical impacts of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. My name is Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to have opening remarks of about 5 to 7 minutes from each of our two speakers, with Mr. Birkenstock leading off. We're then going to have maybe some back and forth between the two speakers, after which we're going to open the floor to your questions. Our speakers' full bios, as usual, are available on the Federalist Society website, so my introductions today are going to be very brief. Joseph Birkenstock is a member in Kaplan and Drysdale's Washington, D.C. office. He joined the firm in 2005 after serving as chief counsel of the Democratic National Committee and practicing political law with a firm in Los Angeles. Brad Smith is a professor of law at Capital University Law School, a 2010 recipient of the Bradley Prize, and a former chairman of the Federal Election Commission. So with that, Mr. Birkenstock, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Well, thanks very much, Dean. I certainly thank the Federalist Society for the opportunity to participate in this discussion, and obviously I want to thank Brad. We've done a handful of these now, and I've always enjoyed them and found them very educational as well. So I'm looking forward to another opportunity to have this discussion. I'm going to assume broadly that people are familiar with the case. I don't want to get too far into the weeds, although I do think it's going to help to have just a minute or so of initial background about what exactly was at issue to put the actual the case in context. The case began as a very technical dispute about how the statute, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, would treat distribution of movies via video on demand. So unlike broadcast distribution that would be just sent out over the airwaves, the nature of video on demand is a little bit different. You're probably familiar with this in a cable system, but you browse through the menus and then you click on the movie that you want to see. Often you have to pay for it, but even when you don't, there's a very affirmative set of steps you have to take in order to see the movie. And the initial question was whether that counted as broadcast TV or radio for purposes of the BICRA restrictions on electioneering communications. Of course, it ended as a much broader case than that. It ended about a case about the overall permissibility of banning corporate political expenditures. So for me, I want to go back and actually, you know, start my consideration of the case with the actual question that was posed initially. Should Citizens United have been able to distribute this movie via video on demand? I think viewed that way, it's hard really to feel strongly one way or the other. I'm kind of sympathetic to the idea that what they were doing was really a media function. It's very much like the New York Times or NBC, you know, things you have to go seek out to go obtain the information is really, I think, where the First Amendment interests are at their highest. It's not only the interests of the speaker to distribute their communication, but if you have the audience self-selecting as people who want to go see what they had to show, it's easy to, for me to see, at least, that should be viewed as a media function and therefore exempt, regardless of how you view it, via the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. There's another interesting way to look at it, though, which is I think there was actually little harm to Citizens United had they lost. Citizens United has Connected PAC that ended 2007, the year before the case initiated, with $850,000 of cash on hand. Total receipts in 2007 of nearly $2 million. The PAC would go on to raise and spend another $1.75 million during calendar 2008. So over the course of the election cycle in question, the movie as it was aimed at hitting during the Democratic primary, presidential primary, over the course of the 2007-2008 election cycle, CU's Connected PAC raised and spent nearly $4 million. And the problem that was posed for Citizens United by the law was that to put the movie on video on demand would have cost about $1 million. So granted, there was a problem posed to the extent that they had to find the $1 million, but that's against a Connected PAC that had nearly $4 million to spend on these kinds of activities during the time period in question. But there's a wrinkle in terms of the timing of this. One of the things that PAC had to do was raise those dollars only in $5,000 chunks. This case came up prior to a different case called Speech Now v. FEC that would go on to overturn that $5,000 limit. And I think it's really interesting. I think Brad and I actually had a short discussion about this after the last time we compared notes on this. But had speech now been decided prior to Citizens United, the CU PAC could have used unlimited amounts of funds. Funds from unlimited amounts from donors to pay for the movie. And I think that actually would have led to a very different result. I think it makes the PAC option look a little bit less burdensome. So if you think about it, take my premises here at face value then. If the $5,000 limit was not such a problem, either because it was about to be overturned or even because the PAC, consistent with the $5,000 limit, raised and spent nearly $4 million in the election cycle, I think Citizens United then can really be understood as a disclosure case. What was left then, the distinction left between the PAC option and the corporate spending directly, is whether or not the entity would have to disclose where the dollars came from. So in the case itself, the justices upheld the disclosure requirements by an 8-to-1 vote. But my observation here is that they did so on the basis of several, I think, very plain mistakes, just simple, erroneous observations. The first of these, quote, a PAC is a separate association from the corporation. In my experience, that's simply inaccurate. Connected PAC, like the one that Citizens United itself sponsored, are the property of the corporation in question. I've come across these in a day job capacity, in merger, bankruptcy, and asset sale contexts. In each of those sets of circumstances, the PAC is very much a part of the corporation. The dollars in the PAC are the property of the corporation. And so I think the observation that Kennedy made, that it's a separate association, really doesn't hold up. He would go on to it and note, quote, with the advent of the Internet, prompt disclosure of expenditures can provide shareholders and citizens with the information needed to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters. Now, unlike the first one, I'm not sure this one is simply false, because he does say can provide as opposed to does provide. But the point is, under the actual disclosure rules that were in force at the time this case was litigated, those disclosures simply don't provide that kind of information. There's nothing in that disclosure regime that allows citizens and shareholders to find out about the corporations, even those that they own, about the political expenditures of those corporations. So finally, the third mistake that I'll note in the opinion is when Kennedy concludes, quote, we now conclude that independent expenditures, including those made by corporations, do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption. And that's a much more interesting one, I think. In every other context, we understand opaque private leverage over public officials as per se corrupting. I've used the example of a honey trap differently, where, you know, if you catch a public official in a compromised position, you have video or photographs or, you know, who knows what, you use that information to go to that public official and you say, look, you better move the highway or you're going to face some embarrassing disclosures here in the press. I think it's the opacity of that really introduces the imprimatur of corruption. And I'm not sure it's much different if the leadership of a trade association, for example, goes up to the Capitol Hill along with the donor to the trade association to say, you know, look, Mr. Senator, that ad that ran against you over our disclaimer with a $10 million buy, the money for it all came from Joe Birkenstock, and he's got some points he'd like to discuss with you. I actually think that's equally corrupting as the honey trap example. It's perfectly permissible under the current sets of rules, and I think it really indicates the vulnerability of Kennedy's conclusion that independent expenditures don't give rise to corruption. But I want to sum up with one other observation. One of the interesting things that kind of leaps out to me about that Kennedy conclusion about independent expenditures is that maybe we're looking at it through the wrong end of the telescope. Maybe it's less actually a conclusion than it is a definition. I'll repeat it. We now conclude that independent expenditures, including those made by corporations, do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption. Well, maybe one way to look at that is that any expenditure, therefore, which does give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption, therefore isn't independent. And you know, even in the hypo that I use, the opaque private leverage, because that actually, in many people's eyes, does give rise to the actuality or at least the appearance of corruption, maybe the conclusion there is that that's not really an independent expenditure. And I think the way to consider that is, that set of facts was not present in the actual case that got litigated here, that clearly didn't happen in Citizens United itself. It didn't happen in Buckley. It didn't happen in any of the cases that the court has used to expand the rights of people to engage in independent expenditures. I think when you compare that set of precedents against what we see now with single candidate super PACs, where the funds for the super PAC are solicited by the office holder or the candidate in question, I think there's still some room left in Kennedy's opinion as to whether the current version of independent expenditures that we're seeing in this election cycle really fit neatly within the kind of structure for independent expenditures created in this case and the ones that preceded it. So with that, Dean, I'll throw it back to you.
Okay. Professor Brad Smith, your opening remarks.
All right. Well, thanks, Joe, and thanks, everybody, for tuning in here or listening to us. Joe makes a number of good points. I think he describes the case pretty well, and I think what are a couple of the key issues here. And in particular, this question of what constitutes corruption, which is one of the key elements at the core of the court's decision. Let me back up and make just a couple of points here. First, one of the problems here is that you had a statute that said that simply because a corporation was involved in funding and communication, that communication could be banned by the U.S. government. And so in oral argument, the U.S. government took exactly that position. They said, look, if a corporation pays to distribute a book or movie, which are technically and rather clearly outside of the statute's press exemption, so if Barnes & Noble is selling books or TriStar is producing a movie, the government's position was, we can censor those. We can limit the ability of people to make those kind of speeches. And in fact, this came up at the oral argument where the solicitor, Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart, admitted to the court or took the position before the court that the government could bar a union from hiring a writer to develop a tract, you know, a pamphlet of some kind, maybe something like why the working man should support, you know, Barack Obama, that it could prohibit the publication of a 500-page book containing even one line advocating the election or defeat of a candidate, that it could prohibit the distribution of books over Kindle. And, of course, this seemed like pretty shocking stuff. And I think it goes to what has long been, in my mind, a flaw in the sort of campaign finance regulatory thinking, that the form, that is the corporate form, mattered a lot more than the substance, which is money and concerns about money in politics. Now, I happen to be a believer that the First Amendment's intended to keep the government out of the issue of deciding who's spoken too much, too little, and so on, that it's more dangerous to give the government that power than to let people spend what they want to spend in politics. But I do understand, and I don't think it's a nonsensical concern to be concerned about very large sums of money being spent in political races. I just think that, again, the cure is worse than the disease. So that's where I'd start, is by noting that the court had almost no choice in my mind but to strike down this idea of a complete ban on spending based solely on the form of the legal organization that people have, whether it's Exxon or whether it's a little tiny nonprofit corporation or whether it's a big nonprofit corporation like Citizens United, at least relatively big. That corporate form is not really the issue. Once we get there, the court strikes that law down, and as Joe noted, there's another case comes along at about the same time in which I'll note I was co-counsel, just so the full disclosure thing, I guess, speechnow.org versus the Federal Election Commission, which says that you can pool your resources. So you put those two together, and you can pool resources, and you can, in pooling those resources, you can take corporate funds. Now, to take it from there, let me shift a little bit and talk more about what has been the actual effect of this on the political process. A lot of people ask about the actual effect of Citizens United, and I think that's often confused or conflated with Citizens United and Speech Now, those two cases. So I'll sort of treat those two cases together, although I may simply refer to them as Citizens United or post-Citizens United world. Clearly what this has done is allowed for more money to flow into the political system. This is not a bad thing. I mean, some people will think it's a bad thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. And I think it's important to understand that the court does not believe that this is a bad thing. Many people have criticized the opinion on sort of the idea that disclosure is not enough to stop these corporations from spending money. I don't think the court considered it. The purpose of disclosure was to stop corporations from spending money. They viewed it as a good thing for corporations to spend money, that they are valuable voices in the political system, and this is discussed there in the opinion. How has it played out then in practice when we put these two together? There is more spending, and I think there will be more spending, and it will come in part because of the presence of super PACs and the ability of corporations, both for-profit but more often nonprofit, to engage in political spending. At the same time, this is not overwhelming the system There's a certain level of histrionics that I think we need to avoid. For example, it's often overlooked that prior to Citizens United, prior to Speech Now, you had 26 states that allowed unlimited corporate spending in elections. And most of us couldn't, you know, just looking, say, oh, we can tell which states those were. Those were the poorly governed states. In fact, quite the opposite. Generally, the states that allowed unlimited corporate spending and union spending by implication were generally viewed as well-governed states, such as Virginia, Oregon, Utah, ranked very highly by Governing Magazine for their government processes and effectiveness of government efficiency and so on. You know, that shouldn't make us realize, or that should help us realize, that this is not a shocking thing, the idea that corporations might spend money and it may not lead to the downfall of American democracy. Secondly, is the amounts of money that have been spent, while they can be considerable, are by no means dominating the system. I mean, through last week, it appeared that super PACs in the 2012 cycle had raised about $86 million. Of which about 20% of that came from corporations, probably a bit less than 20%. Meanwhile, the presidential candidates, President Obama's reelection campaign alone had raised $173 million, or a bit more than twice that amount, about roughly, you know, twice that amount, all in, of course, hard money contributions, limited dollar contributions. All presidential candidates had raised about $330 million, or about four times the amount of super PACs. And that's not before we even start getting into congressional candidates, and Senate candidates, and, you know, all these other types of things. And, of course, much of the money that's raised by super PACs would have been legal spending before anyway. That is, ever since Buckley v. Valeo in 1976, it's been clear that wealthy individuals were free to spend money on independent expenditures. So when Sheldon Adelson gives $10 million to a Newt Gingrich super PAC, it's true that before he couldn't have given it to a super PAC, but he could have gone out and spent the money on his own. So once we realize that, we recognize that the decision, while it's very important, is not quite the tsunami that many people have suggested. Now, what has been the result of some of this spending? I'm going to suggest a couple results, and I think generally it's been good for society. I think we have seen many races become more competitive. This is not the first cycle with super PACs and corporate spending. Of course, that was 2010 at the federal level. And in that in that election year, we saw many congressional races become much more competitive late in the game, in part because of the ability of people to go in and raise and spend money quickly and inject it into a campaign in the form of independent expenditures. In some cases, the leader held on to win. In other cases, the prior leader lost. What's interesting is how often the incumbent who might have been defeated had a huge spending advantage. I often use the example, one of my favorites, but this is by no means an isolated example, is Dan Matthey, who was a congressman from New York. He's complained that super PAC spent about $600,000 in his race, and that's why he lost his seat. And he's probably right insofar as he goes, in the sense that he lost by only 100 or 200 votes, a very, very narrow margin. But what Matthey never mentions is that even including the super PAC spending, he outspent his opponent by well over $1 million. And that seems to him to be, you know, have been perfectly fair and fine. What we see is super PACs have generally entered races to support challengers, and they've been able to do it quickly and make the race much more fluid. And I think that is, on the whole, a good thing. I think it's also brought new voices into the race, and I think that's a good thing. I think we've had a more issue-oriented campaign, believe it or not. I mean, many people would say it doesn't sound very issue-oriented to them. But, you know, the NAACP running ads accusing George Bush of dragging a person to death or being complicit in the death of a James Byrd who was dragged to death behind a pickup truck prior to the 2000 election, that wasn't the height of, you know, positive, reasonable campaigning. Emotional appeals such as the ads that were run in 2004 by Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. And, you know, you could use a zillion different examples. I think actually we have a more issue-oriented campaign in the last couple of elections where people are really talking about the big direction of the country. And I think that's in part due to the availability of super PACs to simply inject those issues into the campaign. So I think it's been a very positive development. I think it's a significant development, not the tsunami that some have wanted to predict. A lot of people who have always favored restrictions here are kind of using Citizens United and trying to claim things are much worse than ever. I think they're better than ever, and I think at least that's part because of what the court has done in Citizens United and SpeechNow.org. That will do it for me, Dean.
And well, thank you, Professor Smith. And let me give Joe Birkenstock an opportunity to reply to anything he heard that might warrant a reply.
Sure. I'll throw in just a couple more observations. I know we want to leave a lot of time for questions, so I'll keep this as brief as I can. There's a lot of what Brad said that I completely agree with, and I've said this before. I'm really not just blowing smoke at Brad about this, but I always thought SpeechNow should have won. I was glad that they did win. I thought that was a really wise and appropriate challenge. They were very well advised by Brad and his colleagues, and they got a well and hard-fought and much-deserved victory in that case. My concerns, therefore, are really not so much with SpeechNow and the idea that people can pool their funds without limitation to make independent expenditures. My concern is, again, specifically with Citizens United, that to some extent it actually frustrates a lot of the gains that we could have gotten out of SpeechNow by introducing the idea that corporations are the ones who are speaking when corporate funds are donated for those purposes. And I like the way Brad described it, actually. In my notes here, I had down that one of his observations was that the statute at issue here was a form-based ban, that the ban was imposed on people speaking through corporations, and that it was not a wise choice, that there are lots of ways people speak. Why is it that this one gets singled out as a means of imposing the restriction? Well, my answer for that is it's precisely because it introduces so much opacity about who it is that's actually speaking. Rehnquist, I know at least initially, had that line about how to consider corporate speech is to confuse metaphor with reality. Now, I grant he would go on to change his mind about that and vote the other way, but I happen to think he got it right the first time, that when a corporation funds an ad, there's no magic going on where the articles of incorporation take on the power of communication. The people are speaking, and they should, and we should do everything we can to make sure that people can speak. But the people speaking are still people. It might be the CEO of the corporation. It might be the head of the Washington office, plus a media consultant and maybe a subcommittee of the board. Maybe it's the actual PAC. Remember, the PAC, the Political Action Committee, typically elected among the PAC-eligible members of the corporation. So as people, they get together and they say, we think this ad is important. We want to help fund this communication. To my eye, Brad had it exactly right in SpeechNow. They should be able to do so by pooling funds without limitation. But what CU really did, I think, was, again, to frustrate that result, to not understand the resulting speech as that of actual specific human beings, but instead to understand it somehow as the speech of the artificial entity and stop the disclosure at that point. So, again, we don't know, contra Justice Kennedy's opinion, who it is that's actually undertaking the speaking. Citizens and shareholders don't know which corporations are funding which messages, and that aspect of this, I think the CU aspect, leaves us worse, not better. But we could have had a better result. I think, again, had SpeechNow come up first, I think it's possible we would have gotten more of the good with less of the bad.
Well, Joe, let me respond, if I can, briefly, just on a couple points on this PAC issue. First thing to be remembered is that most corporations cannot afford a PAC. PACs are limited in who they can solicit, who can give to them. They can cost quite a bit of money to administer over a period of time. Small corporations almost uniformly do not have PACs. It's simply not worth their while. So the odd thing is that to some extent, Citizens United, by allowing smaller corporations in particular to give directly from their treasuries, have actually in certain ways an egalitarian effect within sort of the corporate world. The second thing on this disclosure point simply is that there's a question. First, a corporation can speak as a corporation, and that is different, and it's important for a corporation to speak as a corporation. I think of a little case that occurred in the Scott Brown race up in Massachusetts, the special election a while back, where a small company that did wine distribution through the mail put out some messages to its customers saying, look, you want to vote for Scott Brown because his opponent, Coakley, wants to tax wine distribution through the mail, and that's going to cost you more money and it's going to hurt our business. It's a very important message, and it's one that really ought to come from the corporation, spending the corporate money, that is the money of the people who are members of the corporation. And then certainly when we get political type corporations like Citizens United and so on, there's a question, why do we need to know the individuals who are giving to those operations? Why not just know what Citizens United does and what they're up to? I would add that we have never known, in that sense, who is behind association speak. For example, when the NAACP has spoken, when the National Rifle Association speaks, when Planned Parenthood speaks, when Right to Life speaks, we've never known who are the donors to those organizations. And in fact, it's been a hard-won constitutional victory to protect that information as a matter of privacy, as a matter of preventing intimidation, and so on. Moreover, we don't even know in the traditional campaign finance world. That is, if I were to give money, let's say, directly to a candidate or to an old-fashioned PAC that has to disclose all of its donors, right? They have to ask me for my employer information, but I don't have to give it to them. Moreover, even if I do, you take a person like me, I might just put, well, my employer is Bradley Smith LLC, which would be true, and nobody would have any idea if I get my money from a few lectures I'm asked to do every year and a little bit of pay I get for an article now and then, or whether that money really comes simply because, you know, somebody evil like the Koch brothers or the Soros family or something has given me $100,000 to try to write this sort of thing. And I'm not sure that the public's terribly enlightened by knowing that information. So I don't think even on the disclosure end, the changes that are mentioned are nearly so dramatic as, you know, can be proposed. There's always been a certain opacity there in political giving, and I'm not sure that that's really a bad thing or anything that at least has ever terribly concerned people until suddenly in the aftermath of Citizens United, I think there was an effort to stop the actual speech that people disagreed with and to use complicated disclosure regulations and the possibility of public harassment and intimidation as a means to accomplish that.
Well, we've got quite a large audience here for our call today, so why don't we turn to them and see if they have questions for our experts. Let's go to the first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems we have a problem in educating the public about just what the First Amendment really means and was intended to mean. There have been so many exceptions made to the Congress shall make no law stricture that now it seems like anything might go. And just as an aside, I have actually investigated who uses campaign finance reports and for what, and I find that almost none of them represent the public. It's almost exclusively for intimidation or extortion, especially extortion, because everyone imagines that campaign financiers initiate the influence on candidates, but in fact, more as often as not, candidates initiate the contacts, in effect telling people, donate to me or to my party or bad things will happen to you, and then even make arrangements with opposing office holders to introduce legislation to scare one's constituents into donating.
Is there a question in there, Mr. Rowland?
Well, I'd like to get comments on what I just said.
Okay. Professor Smith or Mr. Birkenstock?
Well, sure, I'll comment, and that'll give Joe a chance for the last word if he wants on this particular issue. I do think this is a problem. You know, the purpose of disclosure is to allow citizens to monitor their government, not to allow government to monitor the citizens. Now, those are often flip sides of the same coin. It's very hard to get one without the other. But when we look at a lot of the current push for disclosure, people say, well, the public has a right to know. But in this case, it's not because the public wants to know for the reason that the court has traditionally upheld some disclosure in the political realm. That is, that it helps the voters understand, who is supporting a message and therefore know more about the candidate or be able to evaluate the authenticity of that message. Rather, increasingly what we see is people who have already evaluated the message, decided that they hate it, trying to use disclosure to find out who's financing it and then to bring secondary pressures on those people to get them to stop financing speech. In other words, rather than engage the speech on the battlefield of ideas, they're trying to choke off the financing for it by threatening secondary harm in the form of boycotts, in the form of sometimes outright harassment, and so on. on the individuals at play. The other problem that our questioner mentions is very serious, which is the ability of office holders to intimidate folks. It can get, you know, very dangerous in certain cases, but even very commonly. James Huffman, a former dean out at Lewis and Clark Law School, had noted when he ran for Senate in 2010 how very difficult it was often to get contributions from people because they were very nervous. First, they couldn't contribute enough money under the limits to really make a difference into whether he was going to win or lose, at least by any one individual contribution. And then they had to deal with the fact that if they gave to him and he didn't win and he was clearly the underdog, then they could be the subject of retaliation by the incumbent office holder or other members of that party. And, you know, for some people, that's just a nice excuse to politely turn, you know, candidate Huffman down. But I think that is a very real problem that we faced. We've put us in a situation where giving a small amount can, you know, endanger many of your interests, and at the same time, you're not even allowed to give enough directly to the candidate to really influence the race. And that's why more money is flowing to super PACs, by the way, and candidates are sometimes feeling like they lose control of the race. Well, it's because they've put limits on themselves, and now there are not limits on the independent spenders. Joe? Dean?
Yeah, thanks. I'll throw in a couple of thoughts because I'm actually working on a piece that goes somewhat in this direction about this idea of disclosure. And, you know, how bad would it be if we didn't have disclosure? Well, you know, Brad, even you mentioned in, I think, one of your earlier sets of remarks, you know, do people know who funds trade association speech or other, you know, entity-based speech? Do people know who funds the Sierra Club or the Chamber, or, you know, whatever? Well, often the answer is no, but not always. And in my experience, at least, it's not at all uncommon for the group that undertakes the speech to hold a trustees retreat or a gathering of its top donors where the member of Congress, often who the ads themselves are aimed at, will physically come to address and meet with and discuss things with the people who fund the group. So we don't know. The public doesn't know. There's no disclosure of that, nor, you know, it's perfectly legal. They're not obliged to make any disclosure of that. But I think the observation I would try to introduce here is, to the extent there's a privacy interest around funding those kinds of communications, I think, to me, it looks like they've waived that privacy interest if they disclose themselves to the public official. And I think maybe the way that this might marry up, I think, with Mr. Rowland's observation is, I happen to agree that the government works for us, not the other way around. Let's take that as a premise. On an org chart, then, I think it's too common. People accuse liberals like me of insisting that, you know, the voters are at the bottom and the government is up at the top. Well, set it up where instead of being at the bottom, the voters are the board of directors, and the elected officials are exactly like corporate elected officials. They're the officers of the corporation. Well, if one particular member of the board goes to a corporate officer and says, now, look, don't mention this to any of the other board of directors, but I need you to do X and Y and Z, the other board members would be, I think, justifiably quite dissatisfied. And that's where I think that disclosure regime kicks in. Well, the communications to the other board members, the communications only from members of the public, addressed only to other members of the public, actually don't trouble me very much. What troubles me a lot is the idea that the dollars being spent on those corporations, on those messages, rather, that is not a message that is aimed at the public. That's a message that's aimed at the public official. And what I'm working on, or what I hope to be working towards, is some means of trying to use that as a little bit of a different idea on where to start compelling disclosure. It makes less sense to me to do this when you use the magic words or because the ad, as you note, Brad, happens to be on TV or radio or somehow within 60 days, but not within 61. But instead, try to hinge the focus of disclosure on what is disclosed to public officials. And if they know, the rest of us should know as well.
Okay. If my information here on the computer screen is correct, our next caller is coming to us from Montana.
Hi, this is Attorney Tim Baldwin in Montana. I live in the state, as you probably well know, who rejects the premises and conclusions set forth in Citizens United. And the question I have really reaches to the core of constitutional interpretation and which methods of constitutional interpretation are really the best ones to get to the result that would reach an originalist view of the Constitution. I have a lot of people in my area where I live who vehemently oppose corporations in general. They think corporations are the sort of bane of liberty, if you will, and so they think Citizens United is a horrible decision. So what I'm curious about is if you know of any historical references or cases to suggest or even to prove that the founding generation accepted corporate funding for speech or elections or anything along those lines.
Well, again, hearing Joe leap in, I'll go ahead and leap in. This is Brad Smith here. I think you have to consider, the idea that the founding generation was specifically saying, yes, corporations should speak, is kind of bizarre. I mean, that's not generally the way that they operated. And in fact, if you look at the Constitution, it's generally an effort to set out specific prohibitions on government power, not to specifically state what people who are not the government can do. And in fact, there are amendments that even make very clear that other rights are retained by the people. In terms of the corporation at the time, corporations at the time were very different than they are today. That is, they were typically granted monopoly powers under special charters. We did not have general corporate statutes where anybody could go out and collaborate and form a corporation. That was simply the standard form of organization for human pursuits. So in that respect, too, it would be very odd for them to say that. But I do think it's clear that they did not anticipate that there would be, restrictions of speech on classes of political speakers. And I think the argument that has to be made nowadays to get anywhere on this is to say that somehow our politics is different because there's so much more money spent, or it's so much more important to spend money, or something like that. I don't think that gets us very far, because in fact you can go way back to the earliest popular campaigns, as we think of them, from the 1830s and so on, and people were making the same complaints as they have today about how much money was spent and how much it cost to run and who was going to do these things. Remember, they were thinking about elections in the context of very small electorate, largely homogenous, restricted to property, white men. It's just a different field. But I think clearly they wanted people to be able to speak freely. And I want to take this back quickly to two points. Joe mentioned, I think quite correctly, that Kennedy, when he makes the statement that independent spending is not corrupting, that's not really a statement of fact based on different people's definition of corruption. Rather, it's a statement of the law. It's a statement of constitutional law, that it's a constitutional matter. We're going to say that independent spending does not rise to a level of government concern that allows the government to start limiting and regulating that type of political speech. And from thinking about it constitutionally, I know that Judge Breyer has written both in a concurring opinion in a case from about a decade ago, Missouri Government PAC versus Nixon, and in his book Active Liberty, that there's First Amendment values on each side of the equation, and thus there's really no room for presumption of unconstitutionality of campaign finance laws. I think that gets it exactly backwards. I mean, the Constitution does say Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Judge Breyer does admit that limiting spending for the purpose of speaking does limit that speech. And it strikes me that while we may not agree that that's absolute, we may believe that there can be some exceptions to that. Clearly, there has to be a presumption, therefore, that a law that would limit campaign speech would violate the Constitution. And I think that's the way that the court generally should approach these things.
Go ahead, Joe Birkenstock, if you have a comment. I'm particularly interested in what you have to say on Professor Smith's comments on the presumption.
Sure. I should probably, stick to that. I will not offend anybody by pretending any expertise on originalist interpretations. The presumption, I think, is it's not that it doesn't make sense. What I liked about, actually, the way Brad explained it, I think it goes back again to some of the points he made earlier. Are you banning the speech if you impose limitations on the means of undertaking it? I think the court's answer is clearly yes. And it's odd to me, though, because is it a ban on your ability to bear arms to ban the use of hand grenades? There's a confusion of means and ends here, I think, that is a little bit difficult. One of the ways Brad explained the concern around independent expenditures, likewise, is that it doesn't rise to the level that allows the government to regulate. And I think just trying to step a few bounces forward with the ball. I mean, where would that kind of conclusion take us in the future? I think the Montana case illustrates, actually, that a lot of people around the country just don't agree with it as a matter of fact or law, that the kind of influence that results, I think Kennedy describes it as favoritism and access, even while that by itself isn't necessarily corrupting, it's not that he's wrong in believing that that's a part of a democracy, but I do think he's wrong in believing that where it's completely opaque, it is still therefore not rising to the level that would allow us to use some kind of regulation, particularly where that's only disclosure instead of the prohibition. And I think if you understand the corporate limitation as a limitation only on means and not on ends, I think, to my eye at least, that would even meet the kind of presumption that Brad described and that the caller noted.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Let's go to Indiana for our next question.
Hi, this is Bill Hodes calling. I'm actually from Florida and Indiana, but I have a Indiana cell phone. My question is one of really just how the case has the political reaction that there's been to it has always just really bemused me. I think Brad has touched on why it has been sort of overinterpreted or used as such a symbol of the current court's craziness rising to the Bush v. Gore level. But I guess I'm looking for some kind of explanation as to how that could happen. Precisely because, as was mentioned, long, long before Citizens United, all the way back to Buckley versus Vallejo, the evil Koch brothers or the evil Soros or the evil whoever it was could make these independent expenditures, what possible difference would it make? And I'm not talking about to the court now or in terms of doctrine, but what difference does it make to the political operatives or to the people who are making propaganda one way or the other, or to the president making references in a speech, that the evil Koch brothers or the evil Soros can use a corporation rather than just simply writing the check? Why has that gained such political salience when factually, really, at least to me, I can't figure out what difference it has made since 1976?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, this is Joe. I will go ahead and leap in and take the first stab, at least, at this one. A lot of that I think I've already articulated, that to the extent the Koch brothers as individuals or George Soros as individuals or, whomever, Boogeyman X, wanted to spend his or her own money on independent expenditures, precisely as the caller notes, since 1976, they could do that without limitation. Over a disclaimer that named who they were, with reports filed at the FEC that names who they are, where the dollars came from, and how they were spent. And I think that really is the distinction that carries the day. If a corporation now can be introduced into that, where an entity called XYZ Inc. is listed properly as the entity on the disclaimer on the ad, obliges itself to file electioneering communications reports with the Federal Election Commission, but simply notes that it received no contributions for the purpose of furthering electioneering communications, doesn't have a PAC status problem because it's not making independent expenditures, I don't think it has any problems. I think there's a way to do that completely permissibly without ever having to disclose to the public who it is that actually provided the money. This goes back, I think, to another illustration that Brad really accurately summarized. This Russian doll problem of, everybody always gets their money from somewhere. I get paid by Kaplan and Drysdale, which in turn gets paid by the clients who in turn make money, wherever they make money. There's kind of no end to it. Well, I think, in fact, there is an end to it. And the end is at the level where a human being decides to use their own dollars, however they've earned them, to spend on political activity. And I think, again, to try, allude to the point that I'm trying to pursue, I am most concerned about knowing who that person is when part of the message they're creating with their spending is a lobbying message to the public officials and not only a political message to their fellow constituents. I think the possibility for corporations now to make opaque what would have had to be transparent in the past is really the difference that CU makes. And actually, I think it does lead to a lot of the public concern around this. The other caller from Montana, I think, accurately noted there is quite a reaction. There's a very vociferous reaction to the fact that corporations now can undertake these kinds of political activities. I'm one who thinks that's probably at least somewhat of an overreaction. But I do think there's a kernel at the middle of it that really is based on exactly this, that we understand democracy as something that's undertaken among the constituency as equals. And when you don't know who it is that gets the private meeting with the office holder to use the opaque spending of dollars as their private leverage over a public official, I think a lot of people are correctly concluding that that's an influence on government we'd do better not to have to deal with.
Well, this is Brad here. A couple points here. First, one thing, I think Bill makes a good point, I mean, again, about the reaction, and we can talk about it. I laugh. I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the case a while back, shortly after it was decided, and Senator Leahy, was the chairman, noted that his state, Vermont, was a very small state and that it wouldn't take much corporate spending at all to just, totally dominate the state's politics. And what I thought was quite interesting about this is that Vermont's one of the oldest states in the country, and Vermont has never banned corporate spending. Corporations have always been allowed to make unlimited expenditures in Vermont, and the state's electing Senator Leahy and other very liberal people to Congress, and the corporations have never taken over and dominated the state. Similarly, we talk a little bit about, since, at least Buckley, independent spending by wealthy individuals has been allowed. We should note that prior to the 1970s, prior to 1974, direct contributions by wealthy individuals were allowed. So Clement Stone gave about $2 million to Richard Nixon's re-election campaign or elections campaign in 1978 or 68, I guess, which would be about $12 million today. And that was, perfectly legal to do. And in fact, that was a major way that campaigns were funded, was by large contributions from wealthy individuals. Gene McCarthy's campaign that knocked Lyndon Johnson out of the 1968 race, again, the last major race before the original passage of the Federal Election Campaign Act, was also funded by a handful of very wealthy individuals who gave amounts that were, in some cases, seven figures or what would it be, over $1 million at the time, and in other cases would clearly be over $1 million in inflation-adjusted funding. And that small coterie of supporters is what got that campaign up and running. So, again, I think that indicates the overreaction. I also think that while many Americans do mistrust corporations, I find that generally what they're thinking about there are large Fortune 500 companies. And I would tell you that to me is not really the company that is benefiting, nor that we see using SpeechNow.org. Primarily what we see using SpeechNow.org are smaller companies, again, that don't have as large a lobbying presence. We see ideological corporations like the original plaintiffs, Citizens United. These are the groups that are using Citizens United and SpeechNow to participate more in the political system. I think that it's interesting to some extent how far, in fact, the debate has moved. I mean, what Joe and I have largely talked about today is the question of how much disclosure should be involved. And don't get me wrong, I do believe that there should be some disclosure. I'm less optimistic than Joe that you can get the kind of disclosure he wants because of the Russian doll program, as he describes it. I think that's a good, image. But also because I do think that the cost of that disclosure are higher than Joe does and the benefits are lower. But it's interesting that I think increasingly that's where we see the battle now being fought, is what is the proper limits there. And I think when people really look at the ultimate, what was Citizens United about, that in that most basic sense, can corporations make expenditures? I think in some ways that has already kind of faded a little bit. The bigger issue has been the idea of super PACs, which are largely funded by individuals, and the question of how much people should be required to disclose, and that's really a question of how far back we want to go in this series of transactions to get to some original donor, as Joe calls it, a real live individual person. So I think this, this will shift. I think the battleground will shift here. Money in politics is always going to be unpopular. There's a gut instinct that people say, boy, I don't like that. I think there's very little understanding of how money actually works in politics. And I think a lot of people, just don't think, you know, long and hard about it. And when they do, I find that they usually begin to recognize that the issue is not nearly so simple as it first appears. It's very complex, and obviously you need to have money in a campaign, and obviously there are dangers to giving the government too much power to regulate that. So that battle will go on, but now in the context of Citizens United, I'm glad that Montana case has been brought in at least one way, which is I think the court will reaffirm Citizens United and further entrench it as a viable precedent, and I think it's a correct precedent.
Looks like we have at least four more people lined up now with questions. We got about not quite 10 minutes left, so I'm going to ask the callers to be direct with their questions if they could, and we'll try and get to everyone's questions.
John Rowland again. Perhaps you could comment on how we might get back to a state of affairs like that in the founding era, when it was not necessary to have a lot of money to get elected, or even in fact, a lot of money would not have made a difference, when all a candidate had to do was to announce, make some speeches. Those speeches were printed in the newspapers, and people bought the newspapers. They paid for their political information. Therefore, now it went from that to a negative demand for political information.
Well, this is Brad Smith here. You know, I sometimes say the main battle in politics these days is between candidates who desperately want their message to be heard and the public, which desperately wants to keep their message out, wants not to be bothered. I don't think there's any going back there to that time frame. I just don't think that it's going to happen. I do think that a lot of spending is driven by the increased size of government. But I don't see that that's going to change dramatically either. So I think we need to figure, we need to come to grips with money in our political system and how people campaign. I mean, there are things like we could reduce the number of primaries, for example, that obviously substantially increase cost and increase the need to be raising money way in advance. But again, I don't see that happening either. People like their primaries. People want their candidates to campaign publicly now. A candidate who said, I'm just going to announce and stay at home and deliver an occasional speech from my front porch is a candidate who's going to lose. So to some extent, you know, if the public doesn't like the spending in politics, they need to look and say, well, you know, I'm demanding it. In essence, I'm demanding that kind of campaign.
You know, one thing that occurs to me is how the Internet is lending itself at least somewhat towards that direction. There has been no cheaper way to communicate simultaneously with hundreds of thousands or millions of people than putting up a web page. And I think you see this a lot more at the local level. I guess, you know, you won't expect anybody to run for Congress simply by really driving the Internet and social media and making that the focus of their campaigns. But I do think the Internet has been extremely helpful in democratizing information and democratizing access to information and making it possible even for insurgent candidates to find means to take on incumbents, even without dollars leading that. You will see dollars usually as a trailing indicator of political success, but I think it's one change that you see over the last 10 years that's made that at least a little bit more, the barrier to entry at least a little bit lower.
Okay, looks like we're headed to California for our next question.
Hi, this is Will Trackman out in San Francisco. I was actually hoping to follow on to the Montana discussion because in that case, I know the court is talking about the history of Montana politics and the background of corruption specifically in that state. I'm curious if there's any wiggle room in Citizens United that the court may actually have gotten a hold of and made it some play in the joints, where we could see a state-by-state analysis of Citizens United and whether the applicability of its holding really exists, or whether it's just a general rule and the Montana court has gone off the deep end.
I think it's much more likely to be the latter. Brad, I'm sorry if I'm jumping ahead of you.
Good.
Yeah, you know, what will the court do? I don't think they, you know, I think they summarily affirm. I'll be stunned. I mean, I think, you know, Brad, I think you characterized it this way before. If so, I agree. They're being asked again, are you sure independent expenditures really pose no risk of corruption? We here in Montana think we have a history that does illustrate corruption. And I don't think they're going to be a written opinion, but I think if you were to get an opinion from Kennedy or from the rest of the majority, they would say, no, you don't. You have a history that shows favoritism and access and influence and lots of other things, but not corruption. I think, you know, where will this go out among the states? You may see some start to challenge it, but I actually think at some point there's a question of sanctions involved once local and subordinate jurisdictions insist on finding ways not to comply with Supreme Court precedent.
Yeah, there are two. This is Brad. There are two additional issues here, I think, that would lead the court not to do anything more with this case. First, of course, if you accept that Montana is special, then you accept that every state is special or every jurisdiction, and you essentially do away with Citizens United as a rule. And I think the court does not think that they made a mistake in Citizens United. I don't think they made a mistake, and I don't think they made a mistake, or that they think they made a mistake. So they're just not going to do that. They're not going to open that door back up. The other thing is that brief little statement by Justice Ginsburg, that I can't remember if it was Breyer or I think it was Breyer joined, saying, you know, we really ought to reconsider Citizens United, had the impact of making pretty clear that they thought Citizens United applied to Montana and the Montana court had to follow the case, and they wouldn't mind reconsidering the case, but that the case did mean that there's no sort of as applied, my state's really, really corrupt, so please let us do this exception.
You know, one more thought I'll throw in, though, by the way, if I recall the caller, Will, I think you said you were from California. One thing you do see states doing, I think California is one that's already done this, as the court has carved back these prohibitions, I see a lot of states saying, you know something, if the laws we're governing don't have the result of imposing bans, as the plaintiffs here and Brad has characterized these laws, if we're no longer imposing bans because we can't, the burden we have to overcome is going to be lower in terms of the specificity and the breadth of our law. So the FPPC in California actually took a step to broaden the scope of its campaign finance laws, in light of the fact that, as they viewed it at least, the express adequacy test was meant to put a very tight limit around the prohibitions of these laws. And if the prohibitions aren't there anymore, it's just curious to me. I think there's some chance that the pendulum swings that way around the map and you see states start to re-explore the outer boundaries of their power if what is in question is no longer a ban.
Looks like we have two questions left and just a couple. Did you have something else on that, Brad?
No. Let's go to the question.
Okay, let's go to the next question. I think we're headed to Arizona now.
Hi, I'm just more concerned with the transparency issue. This idea of waiting 30, 60 days, why can't we just get information in 60 seconds? If somebody's running a super PAC ad for a senator, say, in my state of Arizona, and I want to know who's backing that super PAC so I could figure out whether or not their interests are my interests, or whether I think it's in the state's interest to go for whichever position they're taking. And I need to know that information immediately. And then with technology today, I don't understand why there's any idea that we'd have to wait 60 days to figure out who's funding these things.
Well, this is Brad. Generally, in fact, you don't. In the last days of a campaign, at least, the reporting requirements are very, very rapid, and the information is almost always up on the web within 24, 48, or 72 hours, to some extent, just depending on when the ad is exactly run and how quickly the FEC gets the information up on the ad. Now, you might argue maybe it could even be quicker than that, but the idea that we're waiting 30 or 60 days or we don't know is not really true. Early in a campaign, it is true. We're not requiring this kind of 24-hour filing, all the time. But at that point, you've got a lot of time before the election's going to come up. And I also think that, you know, given the powers of Google and so on now, the idea that you can't really find out who's behind a message or what they're doing simply because they're funding within the last 30 days, although perhaps within much time before that, is not widely known. I just don't think that's a very plausible idea. I think the public has the information by and large that it needs, at least to the extent that we don't get into Joe's issue, that it doesn't go far enough back into who's giving the money to who's giving the money. But the money, the information that is available, I think, on a timely basis. Joe?
You know, I think that's generally correct at the federal level. But the interesting thing, I think the caller's still on to something. That's not true in every jurisdiction, around the country. There are lots of places, actually, that don't have the accelerated episodic reporting requirements for ads or expenditures within a time period relatively shortly before the election. And the other thing I think that has always kind of leapt out at me about the way this works, all of these reporting systems were put together in roughly the 70s, a time when not only did we not have the Internet, not only did we not have fax machines, but we really didn't even have completely cheap photocopying. I am old enough to remember the smell of, mimeograph ink, as people had to stand there with that blue ink and kind of roll the the copies off the machine. So the idea that we need to give people, you know, 2 weeks to file a semiannual report, or, you know, even a month in some places, to file a report covering a six-month reporting period is a function of a time where doing that, actually making that happen, was really a substantial undertaking.
Yeah, and those are,
go ahead, Brad, sorry.
I'm sorry, I was just saying, and those are statutory fixes that I think can be made. So you're right, and that doesn't require a tremendous effort, I don't think, other than the legislative attention.
True.
Okay, looks like our final question will take us to Chicago. See if we can squeeze this in before we adjourn.
Hi, this is Leo Dombrowski, Society member in Chicago. How would the two gentlemen, the decision has obviously generated a lot of heat in the media and on the internet and the blogs. How would the two gentlemen rate the media's reporting of the case, and have you noted any glaring errors in the media's reporting of what the case means?
Brad, you want first ups?
Sure, Joe, thanks. You know, I think most
I have a long
of us
list,
who,
but I'll try to keep it short. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think most of us who work in this field think that the media has done a very poor job of accurately reflecting the case, and I think that tends to be true no matter where one sort of comes down on it. One thing is, for example, we'll often hear that super PACs have no disclosure requirements. At least we used to hear that a lot. I think that's gradually been worn away, that the press has kind of realized that actually super PACs have all the same reporting requirements of traditional PACs. Again, the problem might be, as Joe says, well, if a corporation gives to a super PAC, you don't know who's behind that corporation. But that's a little different than saying they have no disclosure, you know, it's all secret. There's been a lot of confusion about the idea that super PACs are purely a result of Citizens United rather than that sort of combination of Citizens United and Speech Now. There's been a lot of confusion about what the law allowed before in terms of states, what states could do, of what individuals could do in terms of independent spending. Joe may have more examples. I would just note that of late there has been some pushback, and even the New York Times ombudsman has been critical of their some of their at least editorializing on the subject more than the news reporters. I think there's a growing sense that the press has not done a very good job in helping the public understand the case, because having to sell papers and TV time, they focused on, you know, what they see as the sensational aspect, the gotcha aspect, the oh my God, the sky is falling aspect, and that hasn't been helpful for the public to really understand the issues that are involved, so that the public, if it wants to, can call on its members in Congress to address those issues intelligently. Joe?
Yeah, I agree with all of those examples. You know, how do I characterize it? And on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd call it maybe a 3, you know, on average. There are some examples of people, I think, who have grappled with it at a more honest level. But again, I really just kind of echo that. I mean, no matter how you view the opinion, whether you're happy about it or not, a lot of the reporting, I think, is driven by the need to sell a simple story. And, I just agree. This is a topic that just defies simplicity. It's a very complicated topic, and I think justifiably so. And trying to boil it down to something as simple as, you know, First Amendment vindicated or corporations corrupting America, in either instance, I think it's too simple a view of it. I get questions to this day, actually, about people asking about corporate checks directed to candidates and insisting that CU made that completely legal. And, you know, again, no matter how you view the case, that simply isn't correct. That's not what the court held. But I, if you only know what you read in the papers, I think it's easy to see why people get confused about it.
Well, we're going to have to let that be our final word. Let me thank our call-in audience for your attention today and for your questions, your participation. And, of course, I want to thank both our experts for their time today. We are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.